we often miss actually what God is doing in our lives because we don't have the ears, the eyes to hear and see what God is doing. Sometimes that can happen as we go to the Bible as well. There's so many things that God did in the Bible and we don't really see it. We don't actually see the big picture. And so what this session's about is we're going to be moving into looking at how God was working in history through specific people. Remember, our first file was the creation file, right? Now we're going to start on the four people, and you have to think back 4,000 years for us to kind of join together, and we're looking at 2000 BC, roughly, and all the dates that I'm going to give you in the seminar here are rounded to 500 year increments. That'll just keep it simple rather than trying to remember all these very detailed dates. And I want to bring your attention to a judge must judge. The A is for Abraham, the first of the four people. And the starting point for Abraham, it was the city of Ur. The Ur was one of the most southernmost cities. Actually, honestly, it was a seaport city. Doesn't look like it on the map. But back then, the Persian Gulf actually went all the way up to Ur. But it has been filled in through centuries and centuries of sediment that's collected there. So it's a ways away from it right now. But that's where Abraham grew up. Now, was Abraham a rural boy or a city boy? What do you think? He was a city boy. Ur not only was a city, it is known as the first of the great cities of the world. This is where civilization actually began, with the Sumerian people. And this is also on the Euphrates, which obviously being a place where you find water is fertile, and that's where people lived. And so we call that going up the Euphrates River and then down along with the water over in the land of Canaan, the Fertile Crescent. Some people will stretch the Fertile Crescent all the way into the Nile. And it's a crescent shape. This is one of the four major areas of ancient civilization that people lived. The others would be the Yellow River, the Huang River in China, and then the Ganges River in India, and then this one, and then finally the Nile. So this is why it's important for us to kind of know these places. Remember, we dressed the stage there where we had the Sea of Galilee topping the Canaan, and at the bottom, we actually called it the Dead Sea, but it was not called the Dead Sea until about AD 1000. It was the Crusaders, actually, that first called it the Dead Sea. The Old Testament calls it the Salt Sea. It is, I believe, the saltiest sea in the world because it's also the lowest place on earth. And so it's like some Christians who just take in and never give out. You know any people like that? Hopefully you're not like that. Yeah. It receives all this water, but because it's the lowest place, the water only can evaporate. It doesn't pass it out to anywhere else. So it becomes saltier and saltier as you go through history. And then here's our Egypt and with the Nile River there and the Sinai Peninsula. If we were going to put our present locations over it, we would have these various areas cover Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Israel, Turkey, and Egypt. And this area of Israel was known back then as the navel of the earth. Think of your own navel, okay? Think of your own belly button. That's basically the center of your body. And in that sense, Israel was the navel of the world at that time, in the sense that it was really considered the center of the world. We're only looking at basically the land area of the Western world, going to Spain here. But obviously, if you stretch that on out over to China, we really have Israel in the most strategic place in the world. And it was God's plan to move Abraham from a comfortable, cosmopolitan place called Ur and have him live the rest of his life in a rural place, because God saw that that rural place was the place of significance. Can you think of in your own life how God has done that in your life? Sometimes he takes us from the comfortable, familiar, and he moves us to an obscure place, because actually that obscure place is going to have more impact. You're going to have more impact there. He did that in my life. He took me from the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, a big cosmopolitan area, and he moved me to this sleepy little town called Singapore. You know, I'm joking on that one, but when I was a boy, I never heard of Singapore. I mean, Singapore was just some obscure place that I knew nothing about. I didn't realize that God had big plans for a little country, and that he had a part that he wanted me to play in that. So I can identify with Abraham, moving from the familiar city area, although Singapore is not quite like Canaan, because Abraham, when he moved, he lived in tents the rest of his life. And I haven't lived in a tent here in Singapore, you know. That part's not parallel. So remember the Gulf War and the Iraq War? All that starting, you know, be focused there on Kuwait and in Iraq. That's the area we're talking about here. We're talking about the cities of Babylon and of Mosul, that used to be called Nineveh. That's the place we're talking about. And then a new city called Baghdad up here. These are the significant cities of our time. So Babylon, Ur, these are locations we've already seen. How God wanted to move him from there. This was a very, very significant cosmopolitan and inventive area, the Mesopotamian Basin. Because the ancient people, the Sumerians, are the people that we owe writing to. They had writing on little clay tablets. Probably most of us used a wheel. Did you use any wheels today to get here? Whether on a bus or a train or a car or did any of you ride one of those little scooter things that they're populating Singapore? They have wheels on them too. All of us owe this to the Sumerians. Any of us ever benefit from law or medicine or astronomy or architecture? You bet we have. Here we are up in the fifth floor of buildings. You know that five, six, seven floors, that was about as high as buildings were built up until like a century ago? Nobody built buildings higher than that because they couldn't climb as many stairs and the materials were not as good. All that math and all of that geometry and architecture, all that really actually goes back to the place that Abraham grew up. And he didn't just live his youth there. We know that Abraham was actually 75 years old when God called him. That's a good reminder to us, because I would guess that most of us are under 75. And maybe, just maybe, God has something else in store for you that you've never thought of, like my ICS experience that I experienced back in my 30s. You know, it's a wonderful thing to think about, because it helps you just kind of keep looking forward. Lord, what do you have for me? This is the stage of life that Susan and I are in, because we're in our 60s, you know. We're like, what do you have for us in our 60s, in our 70s, in our 80s, you know? It's kind of fun to think about. So the archaeologists have found some evidence of some of the very earliest urban centers there that have set the foundation for us today. The typical ziggurat, an ancient Ur of the Chaldees, you can visit today. And this type of architecture and all this wealth, God caused Abraham to leave. He didn't leave alone, though. He left with his father. Which is interesting because God tells him, Abraham, leave your father and your familiar area, you know, and go to the land I'll show you. He eventually did need to leave his father, but at least the first part of his trip away from Ur, he brought Terah with him. And he also brought Sarah, his wife, whose name was Sarai at that time. Abraham's name was Abram. And then he brought his nephew. I just look forward to talking to Abraham someday and say, now, why did you bring your nephew? And I can understand why you brought your wife, but why did you bring your father? You know, I mean, just a lot of things we just don't know. We're going to have to ask him someday. And so Abraham is the first of these four people, and there's some lines to fill in there on that study guide. So what was God actually doing there? Well, we're picking up the account, Genesis 12 and forward, 2000 BC. It starts with a call. So just write in your space there, the call. This is the call from God. Here's God calling Abraham to leave that which was familiar. And we know in Genesis 12, 1 to 3, that God said over and over, you leave and I will do this, I will do this. The I wills repeated are an indication to us this is an unconditional promise to Abraham. Some would like to say, well, he had to leave, that was a condition. Okay, I'll grant you that. That he did need to leave. But God said, when you leave, let me tell you all the wonderful things I'm going to do for you. So these actually are God promising him a land, God promising him a seed or descendants, and God promising him a blessing. This is an unconditional promise later to become a legal covenant. There's nothing written at this point. But what we find God telling him is the beginning of Genesis 12. The Lord, notice the translation here. The Lord had said to Abram. In other words, he'd said this previously, but the narrator is giving us this at this point. Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. God was calling him to a different land. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. To me, wow, this is absolutely amazing promises here. These three promises are amazing. Let's look at them. Let's see what God's actually saying here. He first says, I'm going to call you to a land. And then I'm going to give you a seed. For most of us, we, at least around my age, we have children. It's not a big deal, but this is a big deal for Abraham. No kids at this point. And then all those kids and the whole nation that's going to come for you, from you, he says, I'm going to make them not only a blessing to you, your family, but they're going to be a blessing to the whole world. You know what that means? It was God's plan when he said that to Abraham, for us to meet at Cum Yam Methodist Church, 17 August 2019. You are part of that, all peoples on earth being blessed through him. I doubt Abraham knew anything about Americans. He never heard of an American. He probably never heard of a Chinese. He certainly never heard of a Singaporean. And yet here we are, 4,000 years later, we are actually the recipients. How many Jews do we have in the room here? Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, minus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I don't think there's any Jews here in this room, but we are truly, truly part of the blessing that God has given here. So we're just going to call this the call. And we're going to see that there are these three aspects of it. Land in verse 1, seed in verse 2, and blessing in verse 3. So we can abbreviate that LSB. Don't say LSD, all right? It's not LSD. It's LSB, as in boy, you know? And what's in common between these? Well, they're all have these overarching characteristics. First of all, it's literal. Okay? God was calling Abraham from a literal land to a literal land. Let's not spiritualize the land. Actually, he's going to give us the boundaries of the land in Genesis 15, 18. Lest we think that, oh, well, this is land, it just sort of means landish. It's also eternal. This is an unending arrangement guaranteed by the contract maker, God himself. And then finally, it's unconditional. It's indicating that no matter what Abraham or his descendants might do in the future, God would in time, and I repeat, in time, he would fulfill every element of the promises. And we're going to see that actually the rest of the Bible is built on these three verses. Genesis 12, 1, 2, 3. In fact, this is the key passage of the book of Genesis. So if you're going to try to remember, oh, what's the key verse of Genesis? Just remember, Genesis 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Okay, that's my little memory device to help remember that. 1, 2, that's the 12, and then 1, 2, 3 means 1-3, those three verses. And so we have Abraham leaving Ur. Suspect he went through Babylon, got water and supplies in Babylon on his way, and they left in faith. They truly left in faith. Based on God's, just his word, just his spoken word to Abram. What would you say if I promised you, let's say you and your wife or you and your husband have been married for 50 years and you never had kids? What would you say if I said to you, don't worry, God has promised you children. Just leave Singapore. Move over to Laos. Just move to Laos, and God's going to give you children. I suspect you'd look at me and go, you are one crazy man. It's not you that have to leave. You're telling me to leave while you stay here in Singapore, you know? It took faith for Abram and his wife, who'd gone probably 5 decades without children, to trust God that God would actually give them children. I think it's amazing, just absolutely amazing that he did it. And they probably passed through the region of Babylon. This is an area where Abraham's descendants, centuries later, would actually be brought in exile. And they made their way up to the top, up to Haran. And Haran, that beehive city where you can see these, kind of looks like beehives now. The Turkish border kind of comes down here. This is not a super accurate map. But they temporarily settled there. And while they were there, Abraham's father died. By the way, if you're trying to remember who actually went there, the four people, just remember the acronym SALT. S-A-L-T. Sarah, Abraham, Lot, and Terah. So they were actually going to the land of salt. The Salt Sea would be part of their inheritance. They left the salty area with the Persian Gulf, and they're heading for another salty area, you know, because God had called them to go to Canaan. Onward. Haran was not where they were supposed to stay. It certainly was a time of grieving for Abram to bury his father Terah and go through the various rites, but he knew that God had called him beyond that. God had called him to leave his father. And now the great stage is set. So when he enters the land, he's already 75 years old. Okay, well, that's one thing, but how about the wife? The wife is the one that has the babies, right? 65. Any woman ever have a baby at 65 years old? Even in our modern day with all of our technology, have you ever heard of a woman 65 or older having a baby? This kind of doesn't really happen, does it? Sarah must have been the oldest mother in the history of humanity, right? And yet his children are promised. So he goes based on that promise. And he's a model of faith for us. I've looked at Abraham many times in my life when God has asked me to do things that are absolutely crazy. Like sign a lease for a new international school. You got $1,000. So sign the lease that says by the end of the month you're going to pay $23,000 in March. You're going to pay $23,000 in April. You're going to pay $23,000 in May, etc. And then finally, in September, October, then you'll start taking in tuition. What? That was craziness in the eyes of the world. You know the difference between risk and faith? The difference is God. That's the difference. Those without eyes to see that God is working here, they say, oh, that's really risky. Or maybe I should not even say risk. I should say stupidity. The difference between faith and stupidity is God. Because in the eyes of the world, a lot of things God asks us to do look really, really stupid. I bet you could give me, each of you could give me 5 examples in your own life. But sorry, we don't have time for that. But I hope you share with others. We've often talked about this with our sons. So Abraham believes God's promise, a land, a seed, and a blessing. He believes it. Genesis 15, verse 6 says, and Abraham believed God, that God was going to do this, and God counted it as righteousness. So God counts belief as righteousness on Abraham's part. In other words, righteousness is not what you do. Because you can do good things without righteousness, right? I mean, you can be nice without being holy, without being pure, without being righteous before God. But to believe God at his word, God considers that I'm in a right relationship with him. Just simple belief. And that is what the Lord asks us to do today as well. I hope you see applications just about almost every single thing I say here. But God is asking for us to place our simple trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, which also looks like stupidity in the eyes of the world. You're going to place your whole future destiny and your whole life now in a man who died 2,000 years ago? Are you kidding? That's how it looks to many people. And so Abraham believes. He believes God. You have to give Sarah credit, okay? Sarah did go with him and all that, but Sarah became impatient. Sometimes it's the husband who becomes impatient. Sometimes it's the wife who becomes impatient. So I hope the one who's impatient looks to the other spouse and says, "Wow, I will follow your patience." But Sarah didn't do that. Abraham was trusting God and what God had told them. You can imagine all the conversations between them. Sarah going, "No, are you sure it was God who told you? Not your imagination," and all these sort of things, you know. We can get talked out of these things, you know. But Abraham says, "No, it was God." She says, "Yeah, but God said we're going to have children. So I guess we better fulfill what God says. But I'm not doing a good job here. I've been working at this for, you know, probably 50 years, 40 years, something like that." So she says, "Go to Hagar." And this was the commonly accepted method back then. If you did not have a baby, there would be like a surrogate mother, basically. And Hagar was their Egyptian maid. And the way they did it, actually, very interesting. They had a birthing stool. I don't know if I want to get all the details of this, but anyway, yeah. My wife goes, no, don't give the deal. But the woman who was having the baby would sit on the lap of the older woman who couldn't have cha, and then have the baby like that. And it was like symbolic of, it's actually Sarah's baby, but it came from Hagar's womb. So they just kind of held each other. Baby came out. Oh, Sarah has a son. Well, not really, not quite, but anyway. That was what they did back then. And in time, Abraham fathers a son through Hagar. And his name is Ishmael. One thing that's quite clear in Genesis is that Ishmael is not the son of the promise. The Lord said he was going to honor Ishmael and bless him, but he's not the fulfillment of the seed promise of Genesis 12. So by this time, Abraham's 85, Sarah's 75. You know, wait. Ever have God just cause you to wait? Not just weeks, months, but years. How about decades? I'm still waiting decades. Decades for my parents to embrace Jesus. You know? And another 15 years they wait. And finally, a son is actually born to Sarah through Abraham. Finally, this is the miracle child named Isaac. Such a miracle that they just laughed when the baby was announced. Are you kidding? Oh, yeah. Let's call the kid Laugh. Laughter. Yeah. Imagine as they grew up every time. Can you imagine naming your son Laughter? Hey, Laughter. Every time you call him for dinner, Laughter. Everybody's laughing all the time, you know? It was just funny that God would work this way. And he's indeed the long-awaited son through whom God's promise to Abraham is to be passed down. It's very clear that even though Ishmael was first, that God does not follow the ways of people. That the line of blessing is through Isaac's line. And so on your little chart there, put I-I. This will remind you of the sons, Ishmael and Isaac. So now, looking back, we realize the Arabic peoples, to a large extent, came through Ishmael. But the Arabs look back to Abraham as their father, and they should. Whereas the Jewish people also look back to Abraham as their father, but through Isaac. And if there's any doubt about, well, which son is actually the one who fulfills the promise, that's kind of an issue that's been debated and kind of basically in our daily news, isn't it? With the issues going on, Jerusalem and all of that going on in that region, the beginning point starts right here. But when God actually calls Abraham years later, probably Isaac is maybe 5 or 10 years old at this time. God says in Genesis 22, take your son, your only son. That really means your only son of the promise, you know, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. Wow. And you know what? Abraham did it. And he wisely didn't ask for his wife's advice, because she probably would have talked him out of it. He got up early the next morning and he did it. He left. The NIV study note says, in the Hebrew text, Isaac follows the clause, whom you love, in order to heighten the effect. Your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Isaac is the son of the promise. And the author, when you get to 2 Chronicles 3, verse 1, identifies the Mount Moriah that they went to as the exact site of the Temple Mount locating the Dome of the Rock today. We'll get into that later. But God hasn't forgotten about Ishmael. He says in Genesis 17, as for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I've blessed him and will make him fruitful. and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. My covenant I will establish with Isaac. Has God blessed the descendants of Ishmael? Oh, just compare the geography today. Look at the land God has given Ishmael, spreading throughout the Middle East, North Africa, all of Saudi Arabia, into Iraq, Iran, down into the stans, you know. And then look how much land he's given Isaac. God gave the Arab peoples 80 times as much land as he gave to the Jewish people. Why? Why such a huge difference? Practically speaking, just look at the geography, you know. Israel compared to the Arab world. That when you bring in Islam, you go all the way down to Indonesia as well. The Jewish people comprise about 15 million today. The Muslim peoples comprise over 1 billion. And in terms of geography, there's no comparison. And Israel gets this tiny, tiny little spot. It hardly makes a blip on the radar there for Australia, or a little bit bigger for France, or the state of Maine, or where I come from, California. But what about Singapore? Yeah, let's put Singapore in there. How big is Israel compared to Singapore? Well, basically, Israel and Singapore have the same width. And then you have to add up a bunch of Singapores north, south, you know. Israel's bigger than Singapore. Don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. God's got wonderful things planned for Singapore as well. But it's not very big. But don't let that bother you. Singaporeans don't... I don't know. Do you guys get bothered that you're from such a small country? No. You shouldn't. You shouldn't, because the issue is whether the Lord is with you, not how big you are, you know? When you put Israel and just kind of spread it over the U.S., it looks like a little disease, you know, actually, you know, little specks all over. God has blessed the United States with wealth and land. God has blessed Singapore with wealth and strategic location, okay? Not a lot of land. But he says to the Ishmaelites were, Hal Lindsey in his book, The Everlasting Hatred, he says, the Ishmaelites were given more land and ultimately more wealth than the Israelites. This is true in their past history, not to mention the vast oil wealth of modern times. And spiritual salvation has always been open to the Ishmaelites. Let's not forget that. But God's covenant, which concerned his spiritual purposes, was only for Isaac and his descendants. The physical blessings promised to Isaac were to facilitate God's spiritual call for the nation that would come from him. And I would add to that, God was blessing the descendants of Isaac so they could bless the Ishmaelites as well. Because we, as we know, we have a call as spiritual descendants of Isaac to share the gospel throughout the whole world. So inside the ancient land of Israel right now, the descendants of Isaac by the UN were given a certain amount of land, really not too defensible, though, with other parts that are primarily the descendants of Ishmael. We have Jews living up in the West Bank and over in Gaza as well. But the majority of that is really... what we have for Israel is being populated by Jews now, but still we still only have about 7 million Jews living in Israel now. So not even half of the Jews of the world have returned to the land. But this is what God has designed for them, to have this amazing land, not only strategic location, but also quite a beautiful land as well. And if you've had the privilege to go to Israel, I suspect you, like I, have been impressed to see just the marvelous beauty of Canaan. especially in recent days, as Israel has even brought water down in the desert areas and made it come to life. It's really quite amazing. So it's clear to us that God's blessing is going to go to through Isaac. And then Isaac has two sons. Isaac has both Jacob and Esau, and it's clear in the narrative also that Jacob is the son of the promise. God's going to bless Esau, but Jacob is the one to whom that promise goes. So put a J and an E, because Jacob is the one who has the 12 sons who end up becoming the line of the promise. Jacob ends up becoming the one who God has called from Abraham through Isaac to Jacob to the 12 sons. And those various sons come along the way across four wives. It takes four wives to get these 12 sons. And then one daughter. We'll give her number 13. All right? That's kind of an unlucky number where I come from. You're probably a little unlucky if you're a girl and you've got 12 brothers. I don't know. Maybe not. That's not something that most of us can relate to. But anyway, these emerge the 12 tribes of Israel. But one in particular, God seems to just have his hand on. And his name is Joseph. And so that's why we're going to have a Joseph folder later on. All right? Well, pretty quickly here. So his name became known throughout the ages, and it bridges over to the next of the four biblical personalities. So that's the point there in relationship to Joseph. Now, the question came yesterday, why are we focusing on Joseph rather than on Jacob? Good question. But you know, it's interesting. Later on we'll see when God gives each one of these sons an allotment of land, he's going to give them each a certain part of the land of Israel. But for Joseph, he's going to give two of them. Because we'll see later, Joseph has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And they each get a tribal allotment. The other thing I find just wonderful here is that you go through Genesis, maybe you haven't noticed, but as you go through Genesis, you'll often see multitudes of sons. But name me a place in Genesis where God chose the oldest son. There's not one place. Abraham was not the oldest son. Jacob was not the oldest son. Isaac was not the oldest son. Joseph was not the oldest son. Yeah. Moving it all along. David has seven older brothers. So, God doesn't do things the way we do them. Their practice was the oldest son gets twice the inheritance. Okay? So, Susan and I, we have three sons, as I told you. So, if we were going to do it the worldly way of the Old Testament, the $4 million that we're worth, our oldest son would get $2 million, our second son would get $1 million, and then our youngest son would get $1 million. Right? Wouldn't maybe should I say $4 instead of $4 million? The oldest son gets $2. No. That's man's way of doing this. Does this relate to you at all as Chinese? Oh yeah. I wonder if you've heard something about this. You know, man doesn't. We've got our own rules and our own patterns and all that kind of stuff. Well, this is very comforting for me because I'm not the oldest son. I've got an older brother, you know, and I've got a younger brother. And this, to me, personally, it's a reminder, God chooses who he wishes and he does what he wants with who he wants. So some of you are going, man, I wish I was the oldest son. Maybe some of you are going, I'm glad I'm not the oldest son. I don't know what you think about that. But it's just a reminder to us that we don't follow our rules and then God follows our rules. No, it should be the other way around. He's God and we're not. Let's get that straight. Sometimes we have a real hard time getting that straight. So that's the second folder of the 10 folders, the Abraham folder. We've covered the creation folder, and we've covered the Abraham folder. Now, what about that J? You know, we've got to go through the AJ, right? And you know that the J refers to Joseph, right? We're only two generations away from Abraham, so we're still going to say it's around 2000 BC. And this is the J of a judge must judge. And this brings us to the end of the book of Genesis, and there's not a whole lot I want to say about Joseph here, because there's only a couple lines here. And it arouses the envy of most of his shepherd brothers when Joseph is the favored of those sons. There's some good lessons for us there too. But he's the son born in his father's old age to his favorite wife, who was not able to have kids. And Rachel finally has this son, Joseph. And the shepherds, all of his brothers, concoct a plan. Their plan is to actually kill Joseph and make some money off, you know. But, I mean, initially to kill him, but then they come up with even a better plan. Hey, let's make some money off of him. So they sell him to some people on their way down to Egypt, which takes Joseph away from the family for many years, over 20 years. And he gets sent on down to Egypt. And everybody considers him, well, the father certainly considers him dead. The brothers, we see, don't really ever recall, they don't ever forget what they've done. But they have no idea what happened to Joseph, who sent down there to Egypt. And once Joseph is in Egypt, among the fabulous wealth and the wonders of that land, and all of his own trials being mistreated and all that, Joseph soon discovered to be a brilliant man with administrative ability. But more than that, it says the Lord was with Joseph. Joseph didn't rise in Egypt, come to power, because he was a great administrator. He was a great administrator because God was with him. He entrusted himself to the Lord, and he never really forgot the God of his upbringing. But he comes to power to be really the greatest in all of Egypt, second to Pharaoh himself. And then famine comes to the land, not only to the land of Israel, but many other lands. And so people end up going down to Egypt because Joseph has special revelation from God that 7 years of plenty are going to be followed by 7 years of famine. And so rather than eating up all the 7 years of plenty, all the grain, he stores it. And he is really a figure of Jesus. He's a type of he's a deliverer, if you will, for his people. And the people go down there. It's a phenomenal account. And we read through all the way through the Bible once a year. But I have a hard time just holding back my tears every year when we get to Genesis 45. And when Joseph finally comes and he reveals himself to his brothers, and he says, through no translator, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery." I'm sure he switched to Hebrew at that point, rather than working through, you know, Egyptian and all that. Those guys must have just been absolutely shocked when Joseph ends up revealing that he has been brought there by God, not by his administrative ability, to save the family. And so the family ends up leaving the land of Canaan, and they go down there because God wants to make them into a nation. And for a while there, they remain in good favor with the Egyptian people. And God uses the Egyptians to save the people of Joseph's family. And they have a respected place, really, among Pharaoh and his household. There's some dating issues here, whether the Pharaoh, the Sphinx there, and the pyramids were there. I don't get into all of that, but they're quite amazing. I hope to go there someday. But the Israelites, assuming that those pyramids were there, they saw many of Egypt's ancient wonders. I've been reading about an Egyptologist lately who's actually putting the pyramids after the time of Abraham. But anyway, the Egyptian chronology is kind of in a bit of a mess right now in that regard, because it's so long ago and we don't have records of these kind of things. But they certainly saw a phenomenal culture there. And God was using Joseph. And under Joseph's leadership, they had lots and lots of children. They had so many kids that they became a threat. God was blessing. And God today still blesses through children. Sadly, we don't really see children in the way that the Lord calls them a blessing. But that ends up in slavery, all right? They end up enslaving those people because they're such a threat. And the account says they were there for 430 years. The 430 years might mean the 30 years in Canaan and then the 400 years in Egypt, but I won't get into all those details. But anyway, about four centuries, they're there in Egypt. And a good portion of that time, they're enslaved. What's God doing here? I think part of what he's doing is he's doing what I would call sweet and sour leading. I love Chinese sweet and sour. Doesn't matter, sweet and sour pork, sweet and sour fish, sweet and, you know, whatever kind of. I've never tasted a sweet and sour I don't like. Because I guess I just like the sweet and sour, and then whatever else you add to it is, doesn't matter. my American sweet tooth, I guess. But God sometimes takes our sweet situation and he makes it sour, is my point. Why does he make it sour? Is he a meanie? No. He mixes the sweet and the sour together because he's got some fantastic things he wants to do in our lives. And so we find that the third folder, the Joseph folder, is one of slavery that lasts 430 years. And so the third of our people that's going to follow is Moses. The big M is for Moses, and we'll look at him when we take a break. But remember, by the way, that all of what we're talking about here is up on the website at Bible Study Downloads. So I would encourage you to download these yourself, and especially teach them or go through them yourself, be familiar with them, be able to teach them to your children. We have a few minutes before the break, if you want them. And so I've gone pretty quickly through all of that, but I wonder if you have any questions. Any questions that we can talk about as it relates to Abraham? So now we've gone all the way through the book of Genesis with the creation folder, the Abraham folder, and the Joseph folder. Any issues? Any questions regarding Abraham's life, or as the promise is passed on to Isaac and passed on to Jacob and then passed on to Joseph? So we've got these four generations, actually, but we're only going to focus on two of them. Yes?
What is the reason for his mouth being blessed so much that eight times the land, or such a big piece of land compared to Isaac? What is the reason for such a difference in blessing?
Oh. That's a good question. What is the reason that God gave Israel such a tiny piece of land, and he gave the descendants of Ishmael such a large piece of land? What do you think it might be? Yeah, the text doesn't specifically say that. Except it does say that God was highlighting that this little piece of land is a fulfillment of his promise. He specifically gives those boundaries. If you look at Genesis 15, verse 18, he promises them that they would have the land from the Wadi of Egypt in the south. It's like the seasonal stream. It kind of goes in the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula, all the way up to the Euphrates River, which, by the way, Israel has never possessed. And if this is an unconditional promise, it means that this is yet to be fulfilled. But we'll get more into that later. It may look like a big piece of land, but then when you look at it with all the Arab land, it's not really that large. I think it's God wants to take the little and make much of it. That would be my... I can't give you a specific verse for it. But if you look at Isaiah 2. Isaiah 2 says, "And then the law will go out from Zion." And Zion, meaning Jerusalem, it's just a tiny city. But God chooses to take that which is little and do much through it. Perhaps if God did it the other way around, if he gave the Ishmaelites the little piece of land, and then he gave this huge area to Israel, Israel would say, look at us. Look how much land we've got. Look at all the oil wealth we've got. Look at all the... Look what we've made of ourselves. But it's pretty hard to do that. When you're tiny and God does something with your tininess, it should cause you to say, this must be God. Am I speaking to my dear beloved Singaporeans here? I didn't hear God mentioned once during the National Day Parade. But every time we watch the National Day Parade, I think, this is God. This is what God has done in this place. And in my heart, I give praise for what the Lord has done among you here. And it's been just a joy to spend the best years of our lives with you all here. But it's not Singaporean ingenuity. It's not Singaporean hard work. It's not Singaporean multiculturalism. These are all wonderful things. But it's God who has his hand on your nation, even as it has been God who's had his hand on my nation. The only nation that I know of in the history of humanity that was established with a charter that mentions God four times, we have these rights, inalienable rights from our Creator, because of divine providence. This is all in the Declaration of Independence, which established the United States freedom. This is the Lord, and we need to truly give credit to the Lord for what he's done in our lives. So, Singapore is, as you well know, has many similarities to Israel. Being small, and yet God has big plans for small countries. And on a personal basis as well. What can God do through an individual? I think of my own life. What could God do through this insecure boy whose parents divorced, age four? I was age four. They weren't age four. But I was 4 years old, and then all of a sudden my father's gone. My father's fighting in Vietnam, and then my mother remarries. Second marriage lasts for 2 or 3 years. Oh, I thought that marriage was going to work. I loved that second dad. Didn't work. I was crushed to see them divorced. And then my mother married a third time. Right around the time when I was age 13, I became a Christian. In fact, God used that to help me become a Christian, because we had a lot of difficulties with the third father. And I heard as a young boy, boy, your parents get divorced, you're probably going to get divorced someday yourself. I thought, Well, I don't want to do this someday. I don't want to go through all this. I don't want my kids someday to go through this pain. How am I going to actually not do this, you know? What could God actually do in my life? I could have been just a dejected young boy, but God had a plan for me. God gave me salvation. God gave me this precious lady. God helped me overcome the faults of my own father has. And Susan knows my parents, of course. You know, I hope she'd say, yeah, there's a few differences between me and my dad, you know. My dad was a very, very, he's a great man in many ways. Would you believe that my dad started the Vietnam War? You wouldn't believe it if I told you, right? Okay, so I won't tell you. No, but actually, my father led the first attack in North Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. It really was an attack. It was a big, you know, propaganda thing. But anyway, but he was there on the first few moments of the Vietnam War. My father ended up becoming a captain. He ended up being in charge of the POWs coming back for the U.S. Navy, for all the U.S. Navy. My father was a very, very significant man in the eyes of the U.S. Navy. But I certainly didn't feel very significant growing up. I think God does that. I think God, I think he just loves taking the little, the insignificant, and making it just wonderful. Yeah, that would be my guess as to why the Lord would take this little piece of land. Also, as we talked about before, that little piece of land is a very significant in terms of its potential being at the crossroads of the three continents. So, great question. Very good question. Other questions? We have a couple more minutes, and then we'll take a break. If it's more important, if it's more needy for you to have a second cup of coffee, I understand that. I'm a coffee drinker as well, you know. But I think you guys just need a little break. Okay, let's take a break.